Hey folks, welcome to the latest episode of the Brief Encounter podcast with me, Johnny Boyle. On this episode, I talk to Rick Jupe, a founding member of the band Elbow. Rick was with the band for over 25 years and left the band in 2016 to pursue other projects. I've been a fan of the band for a long time, and I do focus on their biggest selling record for this podcast, which is The Seldom Seen Kid. It's an album I've loved for a long time since its release in 2008, and it's safe to say it's an album that is all killer and no filler. This record particularly put the band in the spotlight, where they won the Mercury Prize. They won numerous awards, including like the Brit Awards, Ivor Novello's NME Awards, South Bank Awards. They've been a great band for such a long time. So many kind of brilliant anthems on that particular record. And, you know, we talk about some of the reasons why Rick left the band and some of the projects he's pursued since then, as well as some of the difficulties you can have in an ensemble for a lengthy period of time. It's tough being in a band for 25 years. But I really enjoyed talking to Rick, and I hope you like this podcast. We did conduct it on Instagram, so my good friend Duncan Maitland has sparkled a bit of fairy dust to bring out the beauty of both our voices. So I hope you enjoy this podcast, and hope everybody's staying safe out there. So take care, and I'll talk to you all soon. Bye. Here we go. Connecting. Yes, can you hear me?
I can hear you, man.
Fantastic. How are you?
I'm good. I'm a little bit tired today. I've got to admit. How's things with you, man?
Yeah, I'm the same. I'm pretty frazzled. I was on the couch half an hour ago going, right, get it together, man. Get it together. You know? So,
mate, coffee. Honestly.
On the lemon and ginger. It's a bit late for coffee for me, you know. I was contemplating sinking a bottle of red wine while we were having this chat, but it might just get a bit ridiculous. I might reach for the wine in a little while. We'll see. So I know you mentioned, because we spoke about 6 months ago, maybe a bit longer.
Yeah, a bit longer, I think.
We spoke on the phone because we both work in the same college. Well, you work in the Manchester branch and I work in the Dublin branch. And the idea was to get you to come over to Dublin and do a masterclass of sorts. And obviously, nobody's going anywhere right now.
Never going anywhere. No.
And do you want to avoid talking about COVID? Because just...
It's one of them. I was on the phone to Ian Aguado-Bush, who works with Zildjian and Tamer today about doing... doing a Zildjian thing next week, and we were discussing what we're going to talk about. And I mean, it's one of them, isn't it? You've got to kind of, I think everybody's still sort of processing, you know, what the fuck.
Yeah.
Especially today, you know, it's We Make Events, the hashtag that was today, and you know, everybody who works, it's not just the, you know, musicians at the top of the, you know, the cherries on the cake, it's everybody, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I think you know, the more it's in the public eye and ear, it's good. I think, just, you know, I get really fucking angry about it. I mean, I've been really lucky in the fact,
yeah,
you know, that, you know, it's you know, it's teaching, and it's the switch online. As weird as it is, and as you know, confusing for a late 40s bald guy who's done fuck all apart from play drums for the last 30 years. It's a bit of a change. But I don't know, we've got to embrace it, man. So yeah, you know, we definitely chat about it.
Yeah, I you know, it's interesting from doing my podcast that, you know, I've been you know, some people have been reluctant to say put out any music right now, because the minute you kind of put a record out and you use up all your credits with, say, the media and the newspapers, and you can't capitalize on that by touring your record. So a lot of people are holding off, and I do get that, you know.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it makes sense. But then, I don't know, I think you know, on the flip side, people need music, and they need new music. And, you know, I think... you know, we were chatting to some students today, and I've said this to other musicians, you know, and mates and whatever. And it's like, you know, how amazing is it going to be when the whole thing is lifted and we're kind of we're back on it? I mean, fucking hell. Sorry, excuse my friend.
Yeah, yeah.
It's going to be amazing.
Yeah, I think people are just going to leave the house and go to a gig that lasts about 9 months. That's just going to be like, there's going to be like the net, like Glastonbury will be like 6 months long. You know, all that kind of stuff. You know, I'm supposed to be touring a record at the moment, and that's been put off. And I was really looking forward to it because, you know, it was recorded in Rockfield with John Parrish producing. Do you know John Parrish, do you?
No, yeah.
So he produced, and it was a big deal for me working with him. Really, really huge fan of his, and just great guy. And, you know, we were in Rockfield, and we went to Abbey Road for mastering. I'd never been to Abbey Road, and, you know, and I was actually, it was mad because the whole thing was just kicking off in February. And I remember I wanted to, like, my thing, and anytime I'm in London, it's like, go for Chinese. I go down to Chinatown. And with everything that was going on, I was like, oh, do I want to go for Chinese? I don't know.
Yeah. But so, is that full cycle thing? And you know, as you know, it's a long old process to, you know, think of this shit. Just buzzing around in the ether, dragging it down, making it work, demoing it, recording it. You know, I don't know. I hope people do appreciate it, obviously, but
yeah,
you know, especially now. And you know, whether you'd be a hold off releasing music, or you know, you're putting out content, or whether it is for that deeper reason of giving some, you know, something for people to listen to. It's a huge process, and you know, I can see it in your face, man. You know, it's like I want to finish the cycle,
yeah,
so we can then do another one.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
there's
yeah.
nothing like it. I mean, I that's one thing I do miss. I don't know whether it's an ego thing or what, but it's that, just that little bit before going on stage. You know, and you put your monitors in.
Yeah. Yeah,
I used to have this thing with Tom, the tour manager, of putting my, it's a bit dodgy this, but it was okay in the day, of putting my pass on his neck, you know, like Jimmy Savile, would he say that? But, and then I give him my keys and my wallet, and I was kind of like, it was work. It was like, right, here we go. For the next 2 hours, it's all that work and all that sort of rehearsing, and then you hear the crowd, and it's fucking, that's amazing.
Just in the last couple of days, I actually went out for a walk through the day, and I listened to the Seldom Seen Kid, which is obviously, well, I'd be right in saying that the band's biggest record.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's
thankfully
something...
Thankfully,
you're on it. So that's good for your publishing. So, you know, it's funny because I don't know how you feel about this, but there's certain, like, bands that have had longevity and they just hit with that one record. And it's considered their most commercially successful record, probably their best record. You know, it's all killer, no filler. And, you know, I was kind of thinking of other albums that had that same impact on me, you know, like albums like the Red Hot Chili Peppers, like Blood Sugar Sex Magik, or,
oh man,
you know, Soundgarden, like Bad Motorfinger and Super Unknown, and, you know, Ritual Del Habitual, Jane's Addiction, or OK Computer. What, like, was there a feeling when you were making that record that we're onto something special here compared to other albums?
I'm reaching deep down. I think it was because Leaders, we'd had a bit of a shit do with Leaders. I think Virgin, we were on V2 with Leaders, and okay. Virgin had, they'd like lost a load of money with Mariah Carey. I think she'd had a severance pay of tens of millions of pounds. So it kind of hit the company, and that just sort of rattled through all the subsidiaries and stuff. So we didn't have any tour support for Leaders. So we thought that was going to be our, you know, our biggie.
Yeah.
You know, it was of its time, you know, lyrically it was really, really strong. Obviously, Leaders of the Free World, I think it was George Bush at the time, or it might have been Bush Senior, can't remember. And it was a real sort of rallying cry for us. We'd spent, you know, all this time at Blueprint. We documented it all with the guys from Soup Collective. And it was, you know, we spent nights in the studio and, you know, we'd got Dylan, my son, and Sarah, you know, they were on the video to Leaders. We'd done a big fucking push. And then we didn't get the tour support, so we didn't get the support to go out and really push it. And then, you know, Phil Chadwick, manager, top lads, just don't worry about it. We'll get it sorted. You do you. You crack on and we'll sort you out. And as it came out, you know, Jim Chancellor from Friction Records, which is, let me get this right, is a subsidiary of Polydor, which is a subsidiary of Universal, who ironically enough were the ones who bought Island Records and were the ones who dumped us on our first record because we were on Island. I don't know. Can't make this shit up, can you, for this industry? So it kind of got posse the history of Elmo. Welcome, everybody. So it's like, shit, okay, right, here we go again. And Jim Chancellor, what a fucking diamond, what an angel. You know, he'd come to our rescue. But then he had loads of ideas. It was the sort of power of Polydor as well behind, the backing was there. And we sort of, I don't know, it was like, right, let's fucking have it. So we kind of didn't think of that one to be a biggie. We kind of thought Leaders was.
Yeah.
But then it just turned into this sort of behemoth. And I remember the whole one day thing was Guy and Craig, they were sort of knocking about writing, and me and Pete were in Brighton, like mortally hungover, doing a Stephen Fretwell tour. Did you ever hear of Stephen?
No, who's Stephen Fretwell? The name rings a bell.
Amazing. Man on a Roof was the album.
Right.
And I think hopefully he's still on a very, very long sabbatical and he'll be back. But, you know, amazing, amazing musician. And so we were just getting absolutely fucked up on this tour. But really enjoying it, playing with somebody else. It was, you know, it was really cool. And then we were, like, as I say, mortally hungover, and Guy was like chomping at the bit, and he rang us and he was like, right, we've written this thing. It's just a little bit of a din 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 din, and going through it, and you know, him and Craig had been writing this, and then Mark had joined, and it was like just this kind of, that was the, oh, this sounds good, you know.
Yeah.
Any ideas for drums, Joe? And literally, I couldn't even eat. I was that hungover. I was just like, well, I'll just follow that line, you know.
Yeah.
You know, Pete was the same. It was just this kind of like, well, actually, that's going to work if everybody's reinforcing that hook.
Yeah.
And then from there, I don't know, it was just, and then the sessions were like, you know, you've got Bones of You, everybody was, you know, it was a real, everybody was working together.
Yeah.
Not that they hadn't done, but it was something was happening. I don't know whether it was just fate and all that kind of stuff and stars aligning, but yeah, I mean, there you go.
It's amazing because just, particularly listening to this, I know what you mean by saying you just kind of followed the kind of riff of the song, the boom, boom, bam, bam, you know, and you can hear that on the kit. But I've always maintained if something's a good song, it'll just play itself. And as a drummer, you don't even have to think. You just follow your instincts and you go.
Yeah.
You know, but there's other songs on that record that are a lot more atmospheric. You know, forgive me if I don't list off the track listing, which I have here somewhere. But the opener track really sticks out to me because it starts with a really sparse tom pattern. Is it Strays?
Starlings.
Starlings. I beg your pardon. Sorry. I'm going to get this up here. Because I was listening to it and, you know, And one thing I love hearing on a record is a pressed roll, and you have a couple of nice pressed rolls on that, you know, when the horns kick in, because you don't hear that an awful lot. A lot of drummers don't use press rolls, you know, and I'm always trying to squeeze one onto a record whenever I can. There's something classy about them, you know? There's so many, and there's a lot of layering as well, kind of percussive layering. Was that something you kind of just created yourself, or was that kind of a collaborative effort?
Collaborative. I think the one thing that, you know, we were known for was that collaboration, that fact that, you know, it was the five of us, you know, even in terms of the lyrics, you know, Guy was always, from the get-go, it was like, if it was lyric driven or music driven, you know, they would jump on sort of virtually at the same time. It was like, okay, well this is what I'm thinking. Does it fit the sentiment of the song? And that layering is, it comes from, like, we always used to get in there get down to Blueprint and sort of have a bit of a natter, what you've done the night before, what we're going to have for lunch, does anybody want to brew, you know, anyway, all that, and that'd take us to about 12.
Yeah.
It was like, shit, we need to do something today. But we'd go for, like, you know, hunt the sound, so somebody would have something in their heads of you know, Tower Crane Driver is the perfect example, because Guy had a sound like a dong sound, like a dong with a little bit of a vibrato on it.
Yeah.
Once we could have played it in, we could have done it on a guitar or whatever, or manufactured the sound in Pro Tools. But, you know, we tried to do it. We tried to all go in the big room at Blueprint and find it, you know, hit things and try and make this sound. So I think that layering comes from a certain organic, maybe even that naivety that musicians have, or creatives have, which means, you know, you come up with shit that you wouldn't even think about. Do you know what I mean? And you know, we all say that the journey is the more important part of anything, rather than the destination.
Sure.
So I think that, you know, the story about the Boeing sound is that he eventually found it at his sister's place, and he had a cup of tea, and he was walking, and he hit like a little lamp. It was like a china, porcelain, whatever.
Yeah.
And he hit it, and it made the noise. So what he did, he brought the lamp in, and then he made a cup of tea, which was rare. And we recorded him knocking into it, and that was the boing sound.
Yeah. Wow.
And it was every second snare, but then when you pick it out and you hear it, it's there. Do you know what I mean? I don't know. So I think we're trying to give the listener, or we were trying to give the listener a little bit more depth and a bit more, you know, as every band does, as every musician does, and tries to give them a little bit of a 3D space.
You guys, like, how you're kind of coming off 2008, so Britpop's kind of had its day as well. But you guys would have been around for all that as well. Was that a kind of a bandwagon thing that you might have tried to get on, or were you kind of like, fuck this, we're doing our own thing, we're different to the other guys, you know?
Doing our own thing. I think we tried when we were our previous incarnation.
Yeah.
And we tried to write singles and it didn't fucking work.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I think Guy brought along Spirit of Eden, Talk. And that led to, it was a very early version, I think, very similar early version or an influence for tracks like Scattered Black and Whites. You know, those kind of tracks, sort of very linear. There's nothing much happening, but there's a ton of stuff in there. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think that's where we got our sonics from, especially sort of Lee Harris, the drummer. I think that sort of very much loop driven, sort of want, you know, if you find the nod, that's the job. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just get people in and get people just sort of thinking they can play along.
Yeah.
Getting them to sit in. And I'm sure me and Graham were chatting about this, Graham Hopkin.
Yeah.
And just, and even like Ehlich, Dave Ehlich, you know, especially when he twins it with the posture stuff and awareness and, you know, that skill of listening.
Yeah.
You're able to sort of keep time and keep that momentum moving. I don't know. It's a nice platform for you, and it's, I think, a clearer platform for the rest of the band.
Yeah, well, as you say, listening, and that's a kind of skill that takes a lot of years to develop, I think, as well. It doesn't, you know, you see the drummer just sometimes the head down, just playing, and, you know, as the singer says to the drummer, you know, could you not play with a bit more dynamics? And the drummer goes, "What the fuck do you mean? I'm hitting them as hard as I can."
Thanks, spell it.
You know, and it's that thing of, funnily enough, Jimmy Chamberlain, you know, I asked him about,
oh, fucking way,
you know, like, what do you listen to? And he's like, "I'm on the vocal. I'm listening to the vocal, you know, and that's my point of reference." Yeah. And, you know, that resonated with me massively, because I would always be listening to the bass or the guitar. And actually, mm-hmm. when you listen to the vocal and the melody and the rhythm of it, that informs everything else to a huge degree, you know?
Absolutely. There's, I think it's got to be. There was an exercise that I try and copy, and I try and get my students to copy. Benny Greb, you know, when you're doing your dry stuff, so any kind of rudiment based, or you get in a loop, you know, use your legs, keep the quarter note with the left foot, you know, something syncopated with the right foot, so there's a little bit of energy, a little bit of a push. Singles, doubles, paradiddles, over the top, accent or whatever, you know. But once you get into that space where it's you're zoning out a little bit, talk or sing,
yeah,
over the top of it, and just that gets you thinking in. You know, a sort of multi space or kind of some kind of polyrhythm.
Yeah.
But it's a really good way of checking your time and your, you know, your sort of the minutiae of what you're doing. Little buzz rolls, like you say, anything textural can reinforce and be influenced by and influence the vocals.
Yeah.
I think, do you know Slint?
Yeah.
Band. So Spiderland.
Right.
That was just, that blew my off.
Yeah.
That blew my mind, because the drummers were pretty much, just on the album, were just pretty much the vocal line.
Yeah. Yeah.
And actually there was a funny story about Jimmy Chamberlain, because we were in LA mixing Leaders. With Tom Rothrock, and Tom Rothrock knew Jimmy Chamberlain.
Yeah.
And I've been a massive, like, Jimmy Chamberlain fan.
Yeah.
All my life. Them, Soundgarden, Matt Cameron.
Unreal.
So anyway, sat in the lounge bit, everything going on, getting a bit, right, okay. And then, yeah, they just said, "Joe, we just need to chat to you." Fucking Jimmy Chamberlain, we just stood there looking at me going, "Hey, man." And my knees went. My fucking knees went. And I ended up sat on the floor like that going, "You're Jimmy Chamberlain." And he laughed, thank God.
Oh, but, man.
Yeah, he's a fucking...
Oh, we had him in BIM 2 years ago. Now, he's been to the college a few times, but we had him 2 years ago. And, like, he just came in with some, like, Drumless Pumpkins tracks, and he just, like, played for, like, 45 minutes. And What's great is he was unbelievable. He's as good as, if not better than he ever was, you know. And funnily enough, your story of meeting him is similar to mine. I was touring with Marianne Faithfull, and we were in New York, and we did Letterman, and Marianne says Billy Corgan's coming to do Letterman with us because we were doing a song that he wrote for. So I'm thinking, holy shit, Billy Corgan from the Pumpkins, one of my is coming to New York. And what happened was, it was actually, I think we played on the 10th of September. So it was almost a year after 9/11. So Billy wouldn't fly. Nobody was flying anywhere in the States. So Billy didn't fly. But the next day we flew to Chicago, and we were playing in Chicago. And I walk into the dressing room, like, you know, an hour before we're playing. And there's like Olive Zwan, like Billy, Jimmy Chamberlain, the rest of the band. And over in the other corner is like Joe Perry from Aerosmith with his family, you know. But like yourself, my knees just went when I saw him. And all of a sudden, I didn't give a shit who Billy Corgan was. I just wanted to meet Jimmy. But I had to play a fucking gig in front of that guy that night. Do you know what I mean? Like, one of my drum heroes. And he's just, and he was like super nice. He was super nice. And he gave me his email. And, you know, he recommended some drum books. And yeah. And then I bump into him at festivals, and I saw him at South by Southwest with the Jimmy Chamberlain Complex, and, you know, yes. I just kept bumping him into him places. And when I start working at BIM, our event manager, Anne Marie, is really good friends with him, because she tour managed Dinosaur Jr. And, you know, obviously she's Kevin Shields' sister. But yeah. Like 2 years ago, I had, or maybe 3 years ago, I had dinner on Valentine's Day with Jimmy and Anne Marie. In my wife's restaurant, while my wife served us on Valentine's. I read on your Gretsch on the website, the profile. You know, you cite people like Chamberlain, and you cite people like Matt Cameron. You know, obviously we both grew up. We're 90s kids. Was grunge and that whole movement, was that a big thing for you?
I think I remember being really, really into Nevermind, obviously the whole Pearl Jam thing, grunge, you know. It was because it was pretty much, I mean, it's obviously being a drummer, but it was drum led. Do you know what I mean? That there was a good proportion of it was drummer based. Do you know what I mean? And just that sort of freedom aspect, I suppose. I was a big sort of Charlie Benanti, Anthrax, Iron Maiden, that kind of thing beforehand. You wouldn't believe it, would you? I didn't have the hair. That's why I'm even grunge.
The band haven't seen Nico McBrain since about 1976. You can't actually see him behind the kit, you know what I mean?
It's so true. It's so true. I said this to Joe Lazarus the other night. I think his uncle is the bassist. What's the bassist called in Iron Maiden?
Oh, gee, I've no idea.
That's going to haunt me now. Anyway, I was just going to say that, just this sort of this multi-layered kind of drum kit. Anyway, so coming out of that, the grunge thing, I think I don't think it was for the rest of the lads, but for me it was definitely, I don't know, I just love that stuff, Super Unknown and Gish and Siamese Dream, they were the ones that we kind of did bond over. Before that, it was all sort of funk and Santana and stuff like that. So
yeah,
there were these pivotal albums that sort of everybody went, fuck, listen to that. And it was like, oh my God. So I don't know whether it was a sonic thing with people, but specifically it was Soundgarden, not so much Pearl Jam, but Nirvana and Smashing Pumpkins. Definitely one.
Yeah, I mean, for me, you know, Jane's Addiction were that Ritual record, and Living Colour were a big band for me.
Huge. Faith No More as well. Were phenomenal. Chuck what was the lead singer, the first one?
Oh, I know the guy. Yeah, Chuck. I can't remember a second. He died, didn't he? He died quite young.
Did he?
I told you so. I better get a fact checker on that. Can anyone tell me?
I've actually done that a couple of times when somebody. I did it when. Oh shit! What was the Elliot Smith?
Elliot Smith, yeah.
When he died, we were in America and we were having dinner on tour, and somebody for the record company was having dinner with us, and I just went, oh fuck it, I got it off my phone or something. I said, oh my god, Elliot Smith just died, and it was one of his mates.
Jesus.
And I was like, I mean, I fucking done some beauties in my time, but that was awful. And she was like, right, really upset. And I was like, oh, fuck. So, yeah, don't worry about that one.
Well, yeah, well, it's funny because I had last year, I had Nate Wood over in Dublin from Kneebody. Do you know Nate Wood? He's got the Four Project and...
I don't know him, but yeah, I've heard the name, yeah.
Yeah, like Nate, he puts these videos up where like he's playing drums, bass, keyboards and singing, you know, yeah. And his band Kneebody are amazing because I was actually in New York and a BIM graduate just messaged me and said, look, I'm going to see this band tonight. You're in New York. You got to come and see them. And he says, Mark Juliana's opening up. So I was like, well, that's good enough reason for me to go. And I went with my wife to see this band Kneebody. And they were just outrageous. They were like, if Radiohead were a jazz band, this is what they sound like. You know what I mean? And it was like two horn players, drums, bass, and keys. No guitar. All instrumental music, but really good. So, and this is the thing about Instagram. I just messaged him one day. I was like, hey, come to Dublin. Let's do something, you know. But I had him over once. And then I had, the second time I had him over, I was literally driving up the ramp of the airport to pick him up. And I just found out, like a really close guitar player friend of mine, Gavin Rasmussen, just passed away after like a 5-year battle of cancer. And I'm literally 30 seconds away from picking him up, and he got in the car and I was all, hey, great to see you. And I just had to tell him, I was like, dude, I've just heard like the worst news I could hear. So I took him out that night to basically awake in Dublin, you know. And he fair play to him, he was great. And he went home around midnight, I stayed out, and yeah. You know, and he was great. But yeah, look, these things happen. Paul Hester from Crowded House. I don't know if you remember Paul Hester, the original drummer. Like,
yes.
I love that guy. Because he, you know, when I saw them live, I was about 17. Woodface came out. I had Weather With You on it and all that stuff. And as a live band, I'd never seen a drummer like throwing his sticks in the air, singing his heart out, coming down the front and playing brushes. And, you know, he was just manic. He'd be running around the stage. The guy was off his fucking head. I say he was a nightmare to be in a band with. You know, I'd say there was some bipolar shit going on there. But I loved his playing, and I just loved his vibe. He eventually left the band. But I was with the Frames, and we landed in Melbourne. And when we got to the hotel, I just opened the newspaper, and he'd hung himself in a park around the corner, you know. And I know we're getting a little bit morbid now, but that shit is like, you know, a lot of that.
I think it's, you know, it's kind of, it's entirely relevant. You know, especially in the current climate, and for creative people all over the world. You know, if you haven't got that outlet, or you haven't got that kind of support, you know, it's fucking hard, man. And obviously, you know, the industry has had its, you know, it's been cut off at the knees. You know, I spoke to Ian from Hummingbird, the mental health charity for musicians.
Yeah.
You know, and it resonates because, you know, because we are, I hate the word teacher, but, you know, facilitating the next lot of musicians, singers, producers, you know, all sorts. I think it's entirely relevant that you know, us being a part of the industry, we know the ups and you know, we know the downs as well.
Yeah, the ups are great though, aren't they?
Fuck me, the ups are great, I tell you.
but the downs, they hurt. You know?
Yeah, and as you get older, you know, you have to sort of balance the shit out, or else, you know, you'll be sort of hung over for several days. But I think, you know, especially opening up the fact that, you know, a lot of people just think, well, you've got it easy because, you know, all you do is talk about on tour, or you're in the studio, you know, you don't have to work graft 9 to 5. You know, I've not lost friends in that sense, but I've you know, we've had, you know, me and my wife, we've had friends who have supported me by looking out for Sarah when I've been on tour. And it's like, you know, I've come back and I've been, oh, fucking, I'm knackered and blah, 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 you know, this happened and this happened. I was called Vibe Killer in Elbow. I know my son will laugh at that, and Sarah will laugh at that. But, you know, because you're tired and, you know, you've been away and this, that and the other. And I don't know, I'm fucking moaning, and I shouldn't. But it's like, I'd get told to fuck off.
Yeah.
Because it's like, so you don't have to get up at 6:30 every morning to go to work.
Yeah.
And that is absolutely true. You know, I don't. I'm kind of, it's not that I'm lucky or we're not lucky. It's you know, we've worked hard in other ways.
Yeah. And know, sacrificed a lot too.
Mate, you know, honestly. You know, all our mates going off to uni and doing all that shit when you're working at Cussons. I know it's a bit boo-hoo, but, you know, working at Cussons and handballing containers full of shit deodorant, you know, you do what you do to supplement, you know, buying a new drum head or a fucking cymbal or a pack of strings or whatever to pay for that week's rehearsal.
Yeah.
So, but then nobody talks about that sort of the mental health aspect. And I think we should.
You know, well, you're involved with a number of charities, and would I be right in saying you're an advocate for some of these mental health organisations as well?
Yeah, definitely.
So was this something you kind of did out of necessity, or did you do it because you felt this is an area that you could really apply yourself to and kind of you know, contribute to?
Yeah, all of the above, I think. You know, I wasn't the best of drunks.
I'm a great drunk. So go, yeah.
I bet you were, man. but I don't know. It's one of those. It's a difficult one. You know, sort of stopping drinking, stopping taking drugs. You know, just trying to get a handle on it all. You know, you've got family in there. You've got, you know, balancing all that stuff. You know, some people can do it. Some people have trouble with it.
Yeah.
And that kind of trying to plaster over the cracks, you know, when you're away for an amount of time and, you know, you're missing home, but you want to have the fucking best time ever. I don't know, I'm not going to go into one, but it's one of them. And again, I've been fucking lucky, you know. There's a lot of people who are in shit state now,
yeah,
and you know, they have to do jobs that they wouldn't even dream that they would be in a position to do. So, you know, but I think you know, going into stuff, reasons why I left, it became, you know, blatantly obvious that there were no, there were, but not sort of well-known access to somebody to talk to who you would think would understand your predicament.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
That
you weren't just fucking moaning, you know, get it together. You know, you're not factory tomorrow. So, yeah, I think that sort of rang a bell, several bells in my head. Yeah, that's a long-winded answer to your question.
Well, to be honest, I think it's very difficult for a man to admit they're emotionally vulnerable.
Absolutely.
Because it's almost like, you know, if you know, in some people's eyes, if you say, yeah, I'm seeing a therapist, they might think, oh, you're a, you know, you've just given up your masculinity. You know, like, you know, I went to see a therapist for a while, and I've no problem saying that.
Yeah.
I was having a particularly difficult time, and funnily enough, it was a combination of a number of things, you know, financial problems, you know, sick parents, trying to raise two kids, saying yes to everything, and you realize I haven't had a day off in 3 months, and you work yourself to the bone, and actually, I think it was fatigue and exhaustion that really got on top of me, and it would send me haywire. Mm-hmm. So I needed to actually gain a bit more perspective and actually take ownership of my life. That was the thing. I didn't have ownership of who I was.
Yeah.
And, you know, I didn't have any deep emotional problems. You know, it was more just trying to figure shit out. And I think part of that as well was from the age of 22 to 34 being on the road and just living in La La Land, and then coming back and having two kids and a mortgage, and, you know, all of a sudden it was like, hang on a sec, what's this all about?
Yeah, what you know? Fuck?
You know.
One day you go on stage and you know, it's the crowd and the you know, you can have a back admit, great, you know, to standing in the middle of fucking Tesco or wherever and going, I remember, and this is not a badge of honour by any means, and I remember taking Dylan out, because we had Dylan quite early. Well, it was before anything kicked off. So it was like before any major touring, before any Top of the Pops, Adulation, do you know what I mean? That kind of stuff. And it was, you know, I got back off tour and baby Dylan into the pram, right, next morning, really hungover. And I barfed into a bin in the children's playground. And I was like, fucking hell, that's not good, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, at the time, I did think that's going to be a funny story to tell the rest of the lads. They'll have a right gas at that. And it took a few years to actually go, all right, I need to sort this out, you know? And it was funny because Guy always said to me, 3 days before we'd go back home, he said, "You've already left, haven't you?" And I'd be like, I'd have a couple of shandies, and I'd be like, "Right, you know what, lads, I'm going to bed." You know. So yeah, I mean, now you know, my wife is a yoga teacher. She's a counsellor. And she's just about to do a advanced counselling and psychotherapy masters. So,
wow! So you're sorted. You're sorted. Yeah,
she, it's great.
Yeah, she probably turns around. So stop fucking moaning, will you?
Yeah. Come on, wash it off. Get the tea on. and it's great. I was sort of coming back on the Met today, and you know. I don't know. I think I've probably come across as a dick now, but I was sort of stood and I was looking around, and I was so thankful for everything that's happened, you know, and it was pissing down and masks on and all the rest of it. And I had a little bit of a stock take. And as you say, it was like, you know, I'm really blessed in the fact that it's this way around.
Yeah.
And you know, as you know, you probably know, you've got students who you taught last year, some who have graduated and then gone on, and they're going, "All right, how you doing?" And you think, "Fucking hell, this is great. I really enjoy this because I've done that, and I'm able to impart some kind of knowledge, but in a way that is." It kind of normalizes the whole thing, because
yeah.
Like yourself, you've done some fucking epic stuff, and I bet it's all rattling around in your head now. Just that little story of you know, I was in New York and then I was in Chicago and then I've done less.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, fucking hell. This is, yeah.
Well,
I want you to do it. I want you students to do this in 20 years or 10 years and go, ooh.
Yeah, well, you know, I think there's something very rewarding about having a positive influence on a younger person, you know, like kind of mentoring them to a degree.
Yeah.
You know, I had a kid who I used to teach privately when he was about 12 years old, and I used to invite him to sound checks, and he's from a lovely family. Adam Fitzsimons is his name. And we're friends, you know, we're friends now, and I'm friends with his mum and dad. You know, he was the only kid I taught through his teens. I didn't do private teaching back then, but I stayed on with this kid because I saw something in him. And you know those kids that you know they want it. They just want it, and they're prepared to go the extra mile. And actually, he ended up coming to BIM, and he did the 4-year degree. He was an outstanding student. Then he ended up depping for me, and then he was making his own name as a drummer. And now he's living in Berlin. And, you know, and I take an amazing amount of pride in the fact that I played some small part in that kid's kind of trajectory of life. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And there are other kids coming through BIM who you build these rapports with and relationships with. And it's great to see them go on to brilliant things. It's massively rewarding, that is, you know?
Definitely, definitely. And it's, you know, it is the one-to-ones and at Lipper where I work as well. And it's so nice to have this opportunity, you know. I might sound like a twat now, but it is. It's an opportunity to sort of go, do you know what? Don't rush it.
Yeah.
It'll be right. And even if you don't end up in the industry, it'll be right. It'll be okay.
Yeah.
And I know you've got to stick to a certain amount, the curriculum and whatever, but, you know, I mean, it's real world experience. That's what is the best educator. Do you know what I mean? Sorry.
Absolutely. Well, I was only saying something today about, look, when you walk into a room, you've got to project a sense of confidence and a sense of mischief, or a sense of you know who you are, even if you have to lie about it. just pretend you know what you're talking about, and pretend, you know, and just. You got to sell yourself. You know what I mean? You got to look people in the eye, shake their hand, tell a joke. Look like you're a guy that's fun to be around, because people are going to go, well, is this the guy I can be on a tour bus with for 3 or 4 months? Or am I going to pick the guy who's an amazing drummer who's a bit aloof and I'm not sure about him? You know
Absolutely.
What I mean?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is. It's knowing yourself. And it's the oldest... cliche. Know thyself. But it's the sum of its parts, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I suppose if you could go back to your younger self, is there anything you'd say, or is there anything you'd do differently? Like get more early nights.
Get more late nights, man. I tell you.
So that time in your life, like the kind of the height of it, you know, like that, seldom seeing kids sold a million copies. I mean, fucking hell, how do you process that? How do you go from, Jesus, lads, we've done 50,000 copies. We've done 100, and it goes up. And, you know, every single, you're probably getting these numbers and you know, was that a buzz, or was it a buzz when the checks came in?
Fuck yeah. All of the above, man. Jesus. No, it was just because it was so busy. Do you know what I mean? You were there to you know, that jump up to arenas where you're doing sort of 3 or 4 Apollos or Brixton Academies, that kind of thing. And then Phil's like, well, we need to jump up. Do you want to jump up to arenas? And I remember it was like, well, yeah, but can we? Okay, great. And then the sort of realism, you know, the real world thing of, okay, well, now you've got to really get your shit together. You've got 20,000 or 15,000 people in front of you. You know, what do we do? The journey of the set, the fucking intro music. Do you have a B stage? But the B stage is going to cost you, because it's going to take probably 500 people, 600 people out of that standing bit. Shit, man. You know, and then you've got trucks, and then you've got blah, 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 and then you've got this, and it's like, fucking hell, okay. Right, well, yeah, we want to do it. Let's just do it. Fucking
yeah.
Let's have it, right? Because we're never going to, you know, if we look back and we don't do it, we know we're that type of band that this is a one, you know, we're not going to replicate that album. We're not going to sit down and write six versions of One Day, you know, six versions of Grounds. Yeah. So we have to do it now. And don't forget that it was sort of TV syncs that got us that sort of, that's sellability.
Products.
Obviously, you know, you've got a guy who was an amazing frontman. An amazing frontman, lyricist, you know, and the rest. So it was like, yeah, we couldn't. To be honest, I'm still processing it.
Yes.
I'm 5 years out. I'm not out of the game, but you know what I mean? And I'm still processing it. I'm still thinking, what the fucking hell was that all about?
I always maintain it's a bit like you're looking in on someone else's life. Was it all a dream? Do you know what I mean? Because you have all these memories, and you kind of like, sometimes I'm like, did that actually happen? And it did. So I have to pinch myself sometimes.
Well, this is it. But isn't it nice to be in that? To have the opportunity to be able to have a problem processing the fact that you've done X. And I think it's great that, you know, again, we've got the opportunity to tell people in a non-judgmental or a genuine way that, yeah, it was fucking brilliant.
Yeah. And was it a tough decision? Did it take a long time for you, or was it a kind of right? I'm done. I'm out of here.
I think it just. It was one of them, you know, from both sides. I think at the time, and I just went. You know, there was kind of opportunity. You know, I was supposed to fail every opportunity to either jib on this record or you know, get my shit together, because I needed to get my shit together. It was like, crossroads time. Am I going to go that way or am I going to go that way? And for me, it was like, well, I'm going that way. But how do I do it? And for better or for worse, you know, you've got to kind of stick to your decisions, really, and live with them. I've not spoken to the lads, good or bad, since I left. So, you know, but obviously they're cracking on and I'm cracking on, and you know, it is, honestly, it's great. So, yeah, you know, never say never and all of that, but, you know,
25 years, a long time. You know, I mean,
man, it's like 28, isn't it? Something like that.
You know, well, there you go. I mean, you know, there's not that many bands that have had, you know, they might be gone 30 years, but there's been lineup changes, you know, whereas, like, to maintain, you know, that level for that long is that's a huge achievement. But so the last album you played on was the takeoff and landing of everything.
Yeah.
So while I was doing my little bit of research, the approach to this record was different, as it was kind of recorded separately. Is that right? Or remotely, or in terms of previous records, you kind of recorded together. Was there a lot more separate tracking that went on with that record?
Yes. We did a lot. I think we... fucking hell, I can't remember. Honestly, I can't remember. We did a lot. It was a lot more sort of bitty. So yeah, it was remotely, that it was dragged from, you know, different parts. We didn't spend the massive chunk of time in Blueprint, as we did on pretty much all the other records.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know, it was, yeah, to be honest, I don't know whether I've processed that whole thing and that cycle,
okay,
and how it was, it might have been a factor in me doing one. Yeah, I don't know. It did feel very sort of bitty, very sort of, I think remote is probably the good word there, Johnny.
Yeah, remote recording. Remote recording. Well, you know, I mean, after that length of time as well, people do need space from one another. I mean, that disc behind me, like I'm playing with those guys since I was like 30 years, you know. But I mean, I've kind of left the band before. I've joined back. You know, they had a shitload of drummers before me. So, but, you know, I was with those guys only for about 4 years, and then I came back a while later, and we've been doing stuff on and off. It's at the stage now where it's all anniversary gigs, you know what I mean? Now everybody's doing a 20th or a 25th or, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but, I mean, when you think around 2008, right, you've got the Mercury Music Prize, you know, you've got the Brit Award for Best Group, you've got, you know, and then you did the team, was it the team for the Olympics in 2012? You know, so... Seriously, if I was in a band and I was going to the Mercury and all of these events and winning awards, I probably wouldn't be, I'd be dead. I'd be dead. Do you know what I mean? Because when you have that level of success and, you know, you're obviously, that's monetized to a degree as well. And, you know, was there any difficulty in just keeping grounded at that point?
I think there was a sense of imposter syndrome. There was a sense of, fucking give me everything. Do you know what I mean? Sarah, my wife, she was, you know, she was at the Mercury's. There was a bit of a thing about, it's a bit pissed off really, that, you know, when we won, but, you know, our wives and our girlfriends weren't allowed to sit on the table. That was a bit of a pissy thing. They were sort of stuck in the corner. And then we fucking won the night. So it was like, shit, man. You know, we've got to do the job. At the time, you know, we were known for being drinkers, and I, you know, bit of hindsight, I was like, fucking hell, I wish I hadn't got as spannered, because I didn't really take the whole thing in. You know, it's the fucking Mercury Music Prize. We busted our bollocks. Yeah. You know, massive credit to Guy again for sticking to Here's an Hour guns by choosing to do Tower Crane. If we'd have done Grounds for Divorce, which we were kind of advised to do, I don't think we would have won it. I think you can see it in the performance. You know, we're going to fucking win it, and that's it. You know, good luck to everybody. Yeah. But no chance. But I think the fact that we got utterly spannered afterwards, you know, I mean, I woke up with my fucking shoes on, so, you know, fully dressed, and with Sarah going, that was an amazing night, thank you so much. I was like, really? But I think it was the kind of thing. It was like, I don't know whether we'd got a little bit not imposter syndrome, but it was fucking amazing, don't get me wrong. But
yeah,
it was like we're not really like this at all. You know, we're five lads from Bury. But again, it was amazing to dip our toe into that sort of world. But yeah, it's for a certain type of people.
It's funny because you mentioned imposter syndrome, and I noticed on your I think it's on your profile on the Gretsch website, you talk about simplicity. And you know, I think there's something about maybe being a band player that there's always that feeling of when you see the more chops-driven guys that it's almost like, you can't measure up to these people, or you'll never be good enough, or as you say, it's imposter syndrome. You know, and you see that in the classroom as well. And no, I always say that. You know, it's you can't measure yourself up to somebody else. Like I grew up listening to like Ringo and Nick Mason. Like, that's what got me into drums, you know. And my perception of drums was, well, here's a guy that does a thing with a few other guys. It wasn't like this guy on his own is amazing. It's the sum of its complete parts. And you know, and that's, and I still see music like that. Now, don't get me wrong, I'll sit down and I'll learn some choppy stuff, but I'll never use it.
I think it's it is what it is. You kind of do you. Do you know what I mean? You know that bread and butter is more of that sort of band supporting role. I mean, you've got Pat, Jerry, Graham. You know, yourself, me. We're all. And apologies if I've messed out anybody else, but you know, we're all sort of almost like heard but not seen. So you know, you when you're listening to a band, that's what you're fucking doing. You're not listening to a drummer. Do you know what I mean? Sticking their head out.
Yeah.
It's like you're responsible for that area of tone, of space, of space sets. Absolutely, Pat.
I'm spaced right now.
Yeah, you're the responsibility of creating that fucking space. So somebody can move with it. I know I'm getting a bit deep, man, but somebody can move within that, whether it's a conscious or unconscious decision on our part, I don't know. That's where the magic is. But it's like, you know, whether it's 90 BPM, it's what you do within, between those two bits. That's the responsibility then of the other musicians. There you go, Jerry. To move people with saying less is a powerful chop. So chatting to Ash the other night, suddenly it's fucking no Phil. Yeah. And I don't mean that this in a disrespectful way, in any way whatsoever. But, you know, on the Zildjian Live thing that Ash did, everybody's going, oh, fuck. You didn't play on that Phil, on that section.
Yeah.
I mean, to when we were talking to Ash and he was describing what was going through his head, was like, well, it sounded better.
Yeah.
To create some space, and you could hear the room, you could hear the decay, you know, that's bam, bam, bam.
Yeah.
Like, well, yeah, that sounded fucking mint. Because you could hear the decay on the cymbals. You're trying to sell fucking cymbals, for Christ's sake.
Yeah.
You know, you're constantly playing them. You're not going to hear them. So,
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure I understand. You see, my watch does that all the time. Do you hear it? I'm not sure I understand. Fucking, the amount of lectures I've been doing, I've been going, this is the zenith, the end, you know, the fucking, this is it, you know, the Holy Grail.
I thought it was your inner voice coming out to play. You know what I mean?
Let's take it off. Anyway, that's probably my cue to go, shut up. You don't know anything. But simplicity is the key. And I think, I'm not sure. Fucking hell, I'm going to get that now. Anyway, and I think it sends a good message to students as well. Today, you know, you've got.
Yeah.
Ensemble, and they're trying to play with other people, so naturally everybody's a little bit self-conscious, so they're going to play chops, they're going to fill the space. They don't, it's the worst thing in the world, isn't it, when there's space
between. Yeah,
you can embrace that in a musical sense, then I think it makes for a better working platform.
Absolutely. And I don't know about you, but I think with age as well, is you kind of start to realize, well, this is who I am. You know, I'm not going to, in my 40s, try and become something I'm not or something I haven't been, you know, because I think once you, if you've gotten this far, this is the thing, if you've actually gotten, like 30 years later, if you're still doing it, you know, because I remember thinking at 16 years old, you know, if I haven't made it by the time I'm old at 22, you know, I'll probably pack it in, and you keep going, and then at 40 you realise you're not even old yet. You know, or you like to think you're not old. You know.
Well, it's so true. It goes back to what we said before about trying. I mean, it is, again, it's the Holy Grail. It's the knowing yourself to be able to communicate, you know, in the best way possible, what you want to say.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Whether that's in a you know, vocally, or in a musical sense. Do you know what I mean? So if you're sat at the kit and you're chopping and you're actually thinking, do you know what? I fucking wish I'd just sort of just sit on it and do a Steve Jordan. Do you know what I mean? And probably the rest of the band are thinking that. Do you know what You know what I mean? Because what I love you watching is Mr. Hopkins. Just the sound of the kit, the sound of the cymbals, and he's just playing it. And he's just, you know, and Elitch was doing one the other day where he's just playing. And I know he can fucking chop, but especially when he's just laying down a simple groove, and it's just, yeah, it's a beautiful thing.
Absolutely. Well, Graham, I'm buddies with Graham a long time, as I'm sure you have been. And I've always felt Graham to be like a fearless drummer, you know. And, you know, there's a guy that has a body of work, you know. And that guy, you can see him doing his leave-on thing, but Graham's like, somebody was only talking to me about an album he made with a band called Boss Valenti, which is a full-on, it's like turbocharged rock record. And the energy and the fills, and it's just... It's such a killer record, you know.
Well, again, it, you know, Mikey Sorbello, you know, he was the first guy that I did the IG Live thing, and I don't know. I mean, him and Graham are in that same area that they can fucking storm it, but then they can just sort of sit back and are happy being in both. I was going to say both pairs of trousers. Then I don't know what I mean by that.
well, I saw you interviewed David Palmer, who I'd be a big fan of, and he's somebody I'd definitely like to talk to in the future, because I mean, I remember he was like he was the drummer with ABC, and then but particularly there and the Mind Bomb records, which funnily I went for a walk last week and I listened to Mind Bomb, I listened to Infected, which Infected was made in 1986 and it still sounds unbelievable.
86. Yeah,
I think it's 86. It's or less, maybe 88. Actually, it could be 88.
Shit.
And then I listened to, is it Naked Self, which is Earl Palmer. So yeah. Naked Self. I saw Earl playing. I saw Earl playing on that tour with Dead Day in Dublin, what they did was they stripped the whole staging of the Olympia in Dublin and they just left it all bare. So there was no curtains, nothing. It was just walls and stage signs and they just. But they just had this massive light bulb that just they played the first song in the dark, and as the set went on, the light bulb just got brighter and brighter, and that was it. That was the whole production.
That's amazing.
But Earl now plays with Glenn Hansard.
Oh, no way.
But Earl played with Glenn after Graham, and I saw Earl's first gig, and again, another great drummer. You know. But David Palmer is someone I actually... Other than there, I don't know that much about him, you know?
He's solid, just such a lovely guy. And he's done stuff, do you know what I mean? And I didn't really know. It was like an Instagram thing. And obviously I knew he was sort of ABC and Rod Stewart and sort of really high-level sessions. And then literally as I was sort of, because I don't really prep these things, I don't know whether that comes across or not. And I looked and it was there. And that, I didn't mention it before, but you know, that was a big influence on Guy, which was then an influence on us, because you know, he was a voracious music listener. And he brought Mind Bomb in. I remember. You know, we did smoke an awful lot of weed back in the day. And that was, you know, we just used to listen to loads of records. And that was a big one. In both sort of lyrical, attention to lyrical mastery, really. Message and feel and sonics, production.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It was kind of all that. As much, really, as Talk was. Reminded me. And again, you know, music is that great sort of communicator, but also the sort of photograph, snapshot of those times. So now I'm back in Guy's old gaff in Prestwich, Mountview. Not too far away from where I am now, but
yeah,
just smoking weed and listening to music.
Absolutely. I've been corrected by a lot of people here. It's Earl Harvin. I said Earl Palmer. We all know what Earl Palmer is. Jesus Christ, the innovator of rock and roll drumming, for God's sakes. So Earl Harvin, great drummer. So can I ask you, what are your go-to records then? What are the ones you like, just the ones you keep going back to, you'll never tire of, you
Super
know?
Unknown. Yeah. Super Unknown. That's the only one.
Have you figured out that drum break he does in My Wave that's in 5/4? I've no idea what he's doing. It's just, the second track, My Wave, and the guitar is gone and he just takes this. I have no idea.
Mate, honestly, fucking 20 years later, I'm still trying to get that. Boom, bam, 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 dan, dan. That, it's like, it doesn't fit with the start of it. And I'm like, yeah. Go-to is that's just number one. I don't know. At the minute, I've just got the Michael Kiwanuka, because obviously with his Mercury win, I never got into it. But that album, fucking amazing. And I think it's getting back to work. To be honest, I'm not really a music listener.
Okay.
Something hits, I'll listen to it, you know, for fucking days, for death.
Yeah.
Deftones is a big one for me. Again, Abe Cunningham, very, you know, down the line, just holds it for the rest of the band. Gets that space, gets that nod. I don't know, even like Adam Betts is another drummer that I love completely the other way, where it's jungle chops, or, well, it's not chops, but it's, you know, that sort of live drums, lots of hybrid drums. I love that stuff. Shit, I don't know, man. What did I get the other day that I absolutely... I just keep playing and playing and playing. I can't.
Well, it's funny, but it's funny you say you don't listen to a lot of music, because, you know, when I'd be going to gigs in the car, like, the last thing I want to do is blow the head off myself. Do you know what I mean? And this is where kind of podcasts have taken over. Even if I go for a walk, a conversation like this, there's an intimacy to it, which I really like. And it's not too taxing either. You know, you feel like you're kind of earwigging or peeking in on two guys having a pint in the snug in a pub, you know. But could I just ask you about, like, your drum school as well? So is it Jupe or Jup?
Jup.
Jup. So Jup, www.jupdrumtuition.com.
Yes. Get people to just Richard Jup. RichardJupe.com. That's the website. It's a Wix one. It's just a bit of a holding thing. I haven't looked at it for ages, but that just gives you a bit of a lowdown. There's a few sort of testimonials. It's just sort of one to ones. Obviously now most of it's online. I've opened up a little bit for a couple of students here in the shed at home. It sounds like I'm what is it, weddings, funerals, bar mitzvahs, but you know, Skype or FaceTime or whatever, or Zoom's a pretty good platform. I love it. You know, it's that sort of facilitating their learning. I get to learn a lot about how best other people learn. You know, so you've got your 7-year-olds who are just, they want to make noise. You know, they don't really care about the 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, right hand or left hand, whichever hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, kick on the one.
Yeah.
Is that right? 1, 2, 3. Yeah. snare on the three. I do know what I'm talking about. It's that buzz when they get it. You know that. I think any musical instrument or anything, but specifically on drums, it's like when they get it and they get a nod going, and then that kind of panic that they know they're losing it, and it's like, you know, I don't know. I love that. And I think I love the fact that, you know, I've been chatting with Dave Ehrlich about the sort of neurology aspect. And also my, you know, my wife, Sarah, she's very much about that sort of flow state. You know, the yoga that she does is very restorative, sort of hatha yoga. And I do as much, you know, as much as I want, as I can. And also that mindfulness aspect. It's not mindfulness, but it's a mindful approach where you're thinking about your breathing, you're thinking about the space you're creating, you think about that flow state. And you know that flow state when it's all coming together. It's just, you know, hands, arms, head, eyes, ears. It's all just in that sort of moment, and being able to be mindful of that and almost like step away from it.
Yeah.
And listen to yourself and listen to your breath and listen to regulate that breath, regulate the space that you're creating, and imagine, like you said before, like we were talking about the vocals sitting in and out and through and you know, getting on one a bit there.
No, guided meditation. Absolutely. Well, guided meditation is something I started doing a few years ago because I was never able to consciously have a nap. I couldn't do it. I'd lie down. My mind would be just, I couldn't be in that moment. I was always thinking about something I had to do in an hour or tomorrow or in a week or.
Yeah.
And I started these guided, and what I felt was I was doing these 20-minute things where I actually felt like I'd slept for 3 hours. And, you know, because I was, you know, I was doing stuff like teaching all day, coming home, making dinner, and then having to jump in the car and go out and do a gig and get in at 3 a.m. And, you know, I was like killing myself.
Yeah.
You know, and I couldn't actually keep that up, you know. So I had to, the meditation was great, but then I just had to ease off on the work. And funnily enough, even though we're not gigging right now, I'm working in the college Monday to Thursday. I'm doing a bit of private teaching. And I now have a structure to my life that I've never had before.
Yeah.
And I'm actually very grateful for that right now. Don't get me wrong, I want to get back gigging. But just for now, it's actually nice to just take a step back and take a big breather. You know, because I was doing 150 to 200 gigs a year as well as working in the college. And so you were going out Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and then prepping on a Sunday, back into another, or probably prepping in the morning, going out, having a few pints, and waking up Monday feeling like shit. You know what I mean? And because for me, going for a beer with a few friends was just that way of feeling like, well, I have a life, but it wasn't actually doing me any good, you know?
Well, this is the restorative stuff. I know it might sound a bit flowery, but shit, man, if you don't do it, if you don't look after your body, I mean, especially as we are drummers, we use every cell of our body, you know, to create something, but sustaining that, and then you've got to take into account getting from A to B, exactly what you've just said, and then getting from B to A, and then, you know, dad, husband, you know, and then drummer, and then fuck. It's just like, yeah. And this is what I was going on about before, about, you know, not being able to not complain, but sort of have a break and take a breath.
Yeah.
But actually take a breath rather than, you know, getting pissed again in a social sense. You want to, because you've spent all your fucking time doing stuff for other people. You don't have any time to actually drum for yourself and just sit and play, or just sit and just be fucking still for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's really helped me a lot. I mean, stopping drinking or taking drugs has really helped me. But I think just taking the time to exercise, do stretches, do yoga in the morning, and then have a 20-minute or a 10-minute meditation, and then, yeah, fucking get on it.
Yeah.
You know? It makes me more productive. I don't know whether it's
I think the world we're living in now with social media and just being online all the time, it's actually our brains cannot handle the amount of information that we're receiving.
Yeah. So true.
And it can become exhausting. And, you know, I've been asking a lot of people what their thoughts are on social media. I mean, there's a lot of pros. If there wasn't social media, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Exactly.
And there's a lot of people I wouldn't have met, you know. There's a lot of people I would have met touring who I can keep in touch with, you know, and that, it's great for that stuff. But it's the cesspit of Facebook and these antagonistic debates and all that stuff. That's kind of, and don't get, I've got myself into trouble. because and the thing is as well, what ends up happening is I'll make a statement and then I'll try to backpedal because I feel like I've offended someone, and it's someone I know kind of, and I don't upset them. And then it's all a weird vibe. And so I've stopped myself, you know, from and actually, you know, Graham, I have to say one. Graham wants to ask a question. By the way, Graham, will you type that in, Graham? But what I really admired about Graham is everything he puts on social media relates to his profile as a drummer and drumming in general. Yeah. And I think that's the correct way to use it. You know,
absolutely right. Absolutely right. I mean, Twitter is it's great, but I do find myself the other day. My wrist was, I know this is going to sound really bad, but my wrist was hurting. And it was because I was holding my phone like that and then doing that. And I was like, right, this has got a fucking, what are you doing? And, a good percentage of that is work, because I'm checking emails from work. I'm checking social media for this, and I'm checking, you know, this for that, and I'm answering and I'm typing and all this stuff. I just thought, shit, man, if I just take away the bullshit, I'll be fine, because I'll check an email and you write it and then you're checking your timetable and all this and work and stuff and profile. And then you put it down because you're actually busy, you're doing stuff. Anyway, Graham's just...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Graham has said, your drumming brought something ridiculously signature to Elbow Sound, which he's totally right about. What you play is naturally very off the cuff and for the song. So what you played at the UK drum show was fantastic.
Cheers.
Is that a question, Graham?
So I love you, man.
What was the?
I'll give you that fiver.
So let me ask you, what's the future for you in terms of musical projects and stuff like that?
There's a guy from Australia, my mate Nick, who is a producer. He's fucking top lad. We met through Twitter years ago, and every time I was in Oz, we'd hook up, hang out, him and his wife Karen. He used to be in a band, or he still is in a band. I don't know whether they're on a little bit of a hiatus, a band called 26 over in Australia, a guy called Nick O'Donnell. And, you know, we've always kept in touch. And I want to work, you know, we've done some bits and pieces, we've been asked to do stuff, but again, it's just time, you know.
Yeah.
I've got mics set up here, we've got, you know, the Focusrite, and it's one of those things. I'm a firm believer in it'll happen when it happens. I'm kind of not rushing anything. I do want to do more music, but I've spent the last few years sort of focusing on teaching.
Yeah,
refining what I'm trying to do with teaching, what I've got to teach or facilitate. I'm just enjoying family, you know.
Yeah.
Dylan was at a stage where, you know, he was moving schools. He's at uni now. He's a phenomenal drummer, probably because I've not gone anywhere near him, which absolutely debunks all my fucking bullshit about teaching. He's phenomenal now. He's in several bands, and he's kind of at that stage. So Sarah and I are like, okay, well, we'll move back down to South Manchester. You know, as I said before, she's doing a master's. Business teaching and counselling is getting a lot of traction. So there's shit going on, man. You know. Mark's there. Yeah, from Oz. Shipper 63. How you doing?
Oh, yeah.
He's had a few sessions with me. So yeah, big it up. I'll give you that fiver again. So fuck knows. I don't know. I'm really enjoying teaching. I'm loving playing for myself. I'm loving chatting, as you said, you know, getting in touch with people, hanging out. So, yeah, I think Graham actually said a question there, didn't he?
He did, yeah. What did he say? He said, would you be into releasing more music with that guy or even joining another band?
Definitely. I mean, you know, never say never. We'll see what happens. I have been really spoiled with sort of touring and stuff, so I wouldn't necessarily want to get back in the van in like a splitter. But I don't know. I honestly don't know. I mean, I did a few projects when I left. With hindsight, I mean, everything you do, everything for a reason, and it got me to this point.
Yeah,
but. I don't know. We'll see. It's one of them. I think with being able to take a little bit of a breath, it's given me the chance to just enjoy what's going on here and now. Do you know what I mean? Rather than thinking, fuck, I want to be on stage again. I want to do that. I want to be in a rehearsal room. I want to get my degree or get this or go for that. Being able to come in here and sit on that thing and play it.
Yeah.
I'm kind of good with that. The stuff I want to do, yeah, sure, but don't know. I'll say that. That's completely not answering any question whatsoever. That's a politician answering a fucking question.
Well, no, I mean, we don't always have to be making decisions. We don't always have to be moving forward or I'm doing this and I'm doing that. And I do think the older you get, you do want to slow the pace down a little bit, you know, and you don't have to be striving for the next thing. You know what I mean? I mean, I've worked my ass off the last 10 years in terms of college and gigging and raising a family and I'm a little bit tired, and well, not tired, but I'm kind of just going, I'm not beating myself up about.
A bit full.
Yeah, you know, I don't need to practice. Like, I love just sitting at the pad, and I find that really meditative. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I don't know about you, as a kid when you started playing, was it like me? Did you just kind of learn to play songs and you know, But what I've done is 20 years later. It was only then I started to kind of improve my sight reading and learn about technique. And I was just playing instinctively, really. And
that's exactly it. And I would recommend that to anybody. And I wouldn't necessarily go down the reading route. I'd get to know you a bit more first before you do that. I recommend you do that, you know. And again, it's portfolio career. So the thing of, you know, you kind of got to have, you know, fingers in all pies, especially now. And obviously we don't know what the industry has in store after this. So, you know, you need to be even more equipped. Moving forward to be able to do it as a living and be able to pay rent, you know.
Well, it's very different now. I'll just keep you for another 2 minutes, right? So you've got streaming now, you've got Spotify. It's getting harder and harder to make a living and stuff. And plus as well, the younger generation, I find with a lot of kids that come to me for lessons, I'm like, what bands are you into? What now younger people listen to songs. Yeah. I think we need to bring back denim jackets with patches on them, right? That's that, you know, just so you can project your identity to people. It's got, you remember, like, people that have AC/DC and Iron Maiden and, you know, and you knew who that guy was when he wore that jacket, you know? And it's very hard. I'm trying to encourage these kids to you know, and maybe I think they're developing later in that area, whereas when they get to 18 or 19, they start to really kind of hone in on certain bands, you know?
You're absolutely right. And I think sort of that early 20s is our 16, 17, maybe.
Yeah.
Where it was pretty, not cut and dry, but you were part of that tribe and part of that I remember having Adam and the Ants back in patches on my denim jacket, and I was like, I was the shit. You know?
You were the shit, yeah.
I was probably just shit, but you know, it's one of them things. But
oh my god, I'm Michael Jackson. I'm Michael Jackson from the Thriller, from the cover of the Thriller album. I mean, yeah.
Fucking hell. Who'd have thought then, hey?
I remember when I was 14, I had a black sweater, and it had the Virgin, it had Virgin in pink fluorescent writing on it. I mean, it was the 80s, man. What was I thinking? What teenager in their right mind goes around with the word Virgin written on them? I don't think I even realised the implication of it.
Oh, mate, there's some shocking stuff in there out there, I tell you. I'm not even going to go into it at all.
Shit. Well, look, we got to do this again, Rick.
Can we?
What an
absolute joy, man.
No, let's totally do this again. I really appreciate your time, and that mate, was honestly, just a really great buzz. I'm a huge fan of your drumming, and I think the contribution you've made to music throughout your career has just been unbelievable. So, you know, let's just keep on trucking.
Let's do it, man. Thank you.